question, and I'm very glad to answer it as a good introduction to what we have to deal with today. The fate of the churches in America when they became mere denominations. I accept that there is no group in this country that is so central in the tradition of the people at this moment that it is looked upon as more than a denomination. And I use the term sect. Now, I have gone a little bit into studying the American tradition with regard to the term sect, and it is very interesting to find that there's, for example, no article on sects in the Encyclopedia Britannica, American edition. It seems that the word denomination is what has been called a euphemism, that is a kind way of speaking about something disagreeable, which is a sect. So we have today in this country these three expressions: church, sect, and denominations. Now, in secular speech, in a paper, it will always be either a church or the churches in the plural, and denominations. And it seems that the word sect has to be avoided. I wonder if our gentleman from the press would bear me out that this wouldn't be a favorable expression, the term sect. Is that right?
I think you're right.
I have to apologize when I am still in the tradition of the first 1,000 years of the church, which is distinguished there the church and sects. The old church of the first 1,000 years, which was, as you know, still undivided in East and West, in which the Greek and the Abyssinian and the Ethiopian church as of today, far to the Thomas Christians in India, who still exist to this day, by the way, were united in the faith with all the Western Christianity, and where there was no split between Protestant and Catholics either. This great universal church, of course, hoped to be Catholic, that is, over all the earth, represented in every community by one visible body of Christ assembling together, but the congregation form, the church, and not the stone buildings. As time has gone on in this country, when you speak of church, you first think of a building somewhere on Fifth Street, and think, there we go, and then we are in the church. That's, of course, in itself heresy, you see. If there is no congregation in this church which forms the body of Christ, then there is no church. You can have 5,500 buildings in a city, and there need not to be a church for that reason. But we have, of course, in 2,000 years, all these things externalized. Anything that begins, of course, in the hearts of men finally leads to petrifaction, and you now really think when you build a church visibly that there is one. For this reason, I suppose, the term sect is no longer understood. The term sect means, or heresy, means the stressing of one special branch to the breaking point. You have a tree, you have various branches. If one is very rich in fruit, it may break down if you do not support it in time, and it may even fall to the ground, and one of these side branches may then begin to sprout out and send off other trees. That has been the fate of Christianity. And sect then means to be cut off. That's the term, the idea. It has the same root as sex. A man who is not in love has only sex. That is, he is relating his sex urge to himself, which of course is an abuse. You may have sex urges, but that's very, very penurious. You are waiting to be loved, and in this very moment, that part of you that can love, that is made for love, becomes part of a larger whole inside of which you are one of the two parts. And two sexes don't make a marriage, and two sects don't make a church. That is, you can add up the 287 sects in this country at this moment, you still have not the Catholic Church. Because one of you holding one people there eloquently that the sum was only, the whole was only the sum of all its parts. That's heresy. The whole is always previous to the parts. And it is not the sun, and not let alone the sun. Miss Levi, where is she?
You wrote this.
That's just a logical error. See? And it's the prevailing error. All over this country you find this error that groups are analyzed by its membership. And you think that the sum of the members, you see, then gives the group. But if you have a school with 100 lazy children and 10 incompetent teachers, that still isn't a high school. You see, the concept of a high school is derived from a higher order and comes down into these 100. And if they ruin it, you see, they can corrupt it, you see. But you cannot explain by the laziness of the children, you see, and the incompetency of the teacher what a school is. Can you see this? The whole grips these people and tries to incorporate them. If it cannot do this, it's bad enough, you see. But they never, you never must go to a school and say these 100 people as they are, these 10 teachers above them, are the school. They have to comply with a demand. A command is, and I can come to them and say, be ashamed of yourself, this isn't a school. And most schools, most entities are that way. I mean, that they can be put to shame. And as long as you can blush, as long as you can feel ashamed, you are still growing. And therefore, there is still a hole that incorporates you, that lifts you up, that changes you, that transforms you. And therefore, never say this. It's a blatant heresy, of which, of course, the whole church, just all the churches in this country, are to a large extent at this moment. Have come that the membership is a church, but then there would be no church. The church is either from of all times and of all ages, or it's a club. And the honorable name of church should then be replaced by organization, or by club, or lodge, or whatever, society. When Maxim Gorky, the great Russian writer, came to this country and was hounded down here, especially in California, because he took the liberty of the movie stars and lived with a woman, not his wife. He was hounded and hunted down. He had to leave every one hotel in which he stayed, and at the end, when he took ship again for Europe, the newspaper man asked him what he thought of this country, and he was very sweet and mild about it. He didn't resent his persecution and his shocking treatment, just as bad as Fidel Castro has been treated here at the last fortnight. And he said America is a society of immigrants and new people, and therefore has not lived through the tragedies of the people. It has not become grown together into the, as he called, tragedies of the history, you see, of many, many generations. Now, I think this is a very wise word of this much suffering man, Gorky. And the churches had to become here in this country more or less organized societies in order to survive. That is, they have to cater to the public, the taxpayer, the people. Support the churches, fortunately, by voluntary contributions. That's the greatness of this country, that we have no established church, and I'm all for it. And I'm very proud that I help to support my church. But of course, you can easily see that the danger is that then the contributors say that the church has to be conformed to our notions of what it should be, especially it has to conform to our notions what should be omitted. And so the Catholic churches have to play bingo in New Jersey, as you know, in order to support themselves, because that's the easiest way of making money. And there are many other such strange goings-on, you see, where the living generation penetrates into the marrow of the church and makes its demands on it and says, so far you can go and further you cannot. And I had a friend who was lived in Middleton, Massachusetts, where the blue blood of Boston is at home. And their aristocratic congregation, and one day these friends invited me together with their minister and his wife. And the wife was seated next to me, and so she said to me, "My husband really is quite a social reformer. But since he is minister in Middleton, he just has no occasion to make use of it." Do you understand? That's Milton, Massachusetts. I suppose it's Beverly Hills too. He has no opportunity to say these things, you see. They have to be omitted. Wherever the money bag is completely in the hands of the living, you have to take regards. And of course then I read you the line of Melville, the sermon of Father Stoughton Maffitt just doesn't work, you see. Woe to him who tries to please. I think that is one of the obvious reasons why most of you think that this church is a social organization, that it can be organized today. And where they are, it's this way. You, in your own lifetime, have seen tremendous changes which point to the fact that this cannot be so. Because while 10% of the American people were churched in 1800, now there are 60% in churches. And that's too serious a social grouping to be dismissed as just an appendix to the existing day-by-day society. So I do think that against the appearances of the moment, anybody who joins a church has some yearning, as I tried to say, you see, to be lifted up, to be incorporated into something which he isn't when he enters. So that the church cannot be the result of the sum of these 100 feeble-minded, anxious people with a nervous breakdown and a divorce in their back, but there's a future, there's a direction, there's a power of which these people expect to be made healthy, made whole, perhaps even holy. Therefore, the church has this strange aspect of living at the same time at the first day of creation and at the last day. The church, as I told you, is not a church when there is nothing in our existence which is identical to all times. With the main identity, of course, being that we all die, not only when we go to the grave, but many times in our lives. And this constant dying and rising again is, I think, that which all people who are honest with themselves know to be true. Regardless of to what you die or to what you rise, again, every one of you has to, one day should, shake off that he has been a child, shake off that he has been a boy, shake off that he's just an adolescent, shake off that he's just a man, shake off that he's just a husband, shake off that he's just a father. There's always a death. The Saint Augustine, who I think is the most modern and most, so to speak, unused thinkers, whom the only man perhaps of the Occident, whom we will have to take into our future, has said, very poignantly, as many ages, as many deaths. As many ages, as many deaths. Anybody who cares to know the Latin word should take it down, because you cannot express in English anything in such a poignant way as you can in Latin. What etates, as many ages as they are, tot mortis, so many deaths. Now, it's very unfortunate that the word death in our language is never used in the plural. You see, deaths, I mean, really means very little. You better get acquainted with the fact that in our modern society, more than in any other age of the world, a man has to die more than once, and a woman too. She has to stop to be a girl. And if she's a girl at 70, then she has just missed the best. She has missed her life. She has failed to live. In order to help you, I must tell you that you have to in this recognition that we are in a life struggle, and it is a miracle every night that we wake up again and have overcome the danger of dying. If you see that all life means all the time to escape, to survive, that survival is just another description of the life process itself. You see, life and survival is identical, because at any one moment the mechanisms of life are trying to throttle us, to infect us, to disease us, to starve us, to choke us, and in many ways death is a daily attack, onslaught on you. You are young and you don't know this, but it is true, just the same, that you are just as much at this moment in danger of your mental death. I've seen in my statistics of my own students, I think that out of 4,000 to 5,000 students whom I have tried to educate during my activities here in this country, 3,000 were dead at the 30th year. They hadn't know to dismiss being a student, so they come back after 30 years, 40 years as alumni in this childish manner with their caps on, proving thereby that they hadn't died to their college days. Quod mortis tot aetatis, or quod aetatis tot mortis, you can put it both ways. If you read, however, there is a difficulty for the churches today to inculcate this, for what they stand, that's their whole doctrine. That we recognize each other by this fact of our common dying and our common rising. That this is our humanity. That we know that every one of us has to bury his dead. And funerals should connect people. It's a tremendous experience that everyone has to bury something. Why doesn't it work? I have to tell you this, I think, before we advance to the problem of the ecumenic church at this moment. I'm still dealing with the problem why the church today has become in America a daily sect, a sect of one day. And the next church in 30 years has no memory of what it was, or what it was 30 years ago. That there is no continuity at this moment, despite all this feverish activity of our churches. I think that the biological heresy today has produced this. I looked at the hospital next door of us, at home, into, when I had to wait for the doctor, into the textbook of biology. And there the definition of life runs, life is a factory which can produce other factories. Now this is today sold as science. The man who wrote this book has sold 20 editions. It is, of course, obvious nonsense. But that's today sold as biology. The main topic of biology is to omit death. Life is, as another biologist in Europe has written in his biology very poignantly, very pathetically, life is that process which produces corpses. Which produces corpses. That all life, you see, leads to something that is finished, something that is complete. That's a corpse. And then the spirit moves into other places. It moves on. And so life is not thinkable without death. Death is inherent. In the very moment that the baby is born, it is born as mortal. And when you look at the mask, the death mask of Beethoven, you know that this is a fulfilled life. There was just nothing more to add. This carving, you see, of his features is what he was made for. Or Napoleon. Have you ever seen Napoleon's mask? Also a very beautiful one. That is, when Spengler was asked why he wrote The Decline of the West, he said it could also have been called The Perfection of the West. His book was called in German not The Decline quite, but The End of the West. So he said end and perfection should be the same. When a civilization has perfected itself to a certain point, you see, to a certain refinement, it cannot go on from there. It is finished. That's not a scandal, that's not an accusation, you see, and that's not a verdict of good and evil. It just means that in history all processes have their appointed end. Just as the promise of America is fulfilled in Los Angeles. You can't go further. South California, in a way, is a fulfillment of all the dreams of the immigrants and the East, and the Eastern Shore. And if anybody had shown them South California, Southern California, you see, in 1620, they would have thought that they didn't have to live. It was all there. Fulfillment and promise go together, perfection and hopes go together, and life and death go together. And that's just one and the same thing. Since, however, you are all biology drunk, you all live by a mechanical view of life, you omit death. And the churches do the same because they have to do with educated people. And they cannot offend these educated people, you see. And therefore they must never mention death. And they are perfectly hopeless. I mean, when you see why our churches are not churches, you can see this from their helplessness at funerals. They're perfectly helpless, and I don't have to tell you in Los Angeles how helpless they are. I mean, here's a famous book written on this topic. I hope you all have read it. Who hasn't heard of the book? I hope you all have. See? By Evelyn Moore. No?
Yeah, The Loved Ones. That's
terrific.
What?
The
Loved
Ones. The Loved Ones, yes. You see? The Loved Ones. Well, perhaps some of you have lots already on Forest Lane Cemetery. There you are declared. You see, there's a man standing on the cemetery, and he says, when the coffin is brought in, by the authority vested in me, formed by the trustees of the cemetery, I herewith declare you immortal. See, that's the abolition of death. Because we are only promised death and resurrection. We are never promised immortality. The word immortal is not found in the Bible. Death is the condition of life and of rising again. If you don't die, nothing doing, gentlemen. But in Los Angeles, I think it's the only place under the sky that has gone so far, death is abolished. And people pay for that. Money. Very interesting. I wish I could make money that easily. So this is, I think, the real situation of the church. Every church here has become a sect, in as far as it embalms, in as far as it buys platinum coffins or zinc coffins, so that the men must not die. This attempt to hide the grim fact that this body is dead, you see, is very funny, extremely funny. But the undertaker, you see, is, of course, the man who takes advantage of your tears at the moment that you die. Your widow is beset by these sharks, and they say that the best coffin is just, of course, the only thing worthy of this wonderful dead man there. And so you spend all the family fortune on the funeral. As long as you have this situation, gentlemen, America is still a society of the living, in which death is made pleasant. It is eliminated. People must be weak. They keep smiling. And they are proud that the widow is able to stand the funeral. I think it would be much more honest if she said, I can't stand that. So a church that doesn't put the death, the real death of all of us, you and me, into the center, is unable to connect the ages, because the link by which we are one man through the ages is the death of every cell of this living body. You see, not the life. But at the moment of death, our faith is restored that despite this death, the spirit moves on. There is one spirit through the ages. If there is, no church. And then the more this is forgotten, the church must cater to the public. You have today, the church is split up, as you know, in age groups. The married couples, the young married couples, the divorced couples. Idiotic, you see, that's in society. The church obviously makes the old speak to the babies, and the women speak to the men, and the elder people speak to the younger people. Otherwise, it's not a church. But this zebra, you see, organization of our modern society, which hires a man at 60, you see, and forces a man into school, even an Amish man, you see, down to the age of 28 before he can get his PhD. These family divisions of our age groups, you see, where you are ranked with class of 59 or class of 62, you see. And that's what you are, so to speak. And the spirit of this special year, then, is your stigma for the rest of your life. This is, of course, against the church. The church is absolutely indifferent to age, completely indifferent. No man is better while he's younger, no man is better while he's older. In this country, however, today the belief is younger is better, newer is better, faster is better. As long as you have these things also in the church, into the church coming, there is no church. The church has complete immunity against sensation and against tradition. It is nothing is good because it is tradition, and nothing is good because it is new. You see, there are diabolical traditions and there are diabolical innovations. And that's just the difficulty, you see, that you have to decide where the devil is and where God is. Because everybody does it tomorrow a different manner, that doesn't mean that tomorrow doesn't go to hell. So the churches are very hard put, and that is, I think, a negative side I should stress, because regardless of this intrusion of the daily society and its prejudices, its scientific prejudices, especially from biology, that you can treat life as a mechanism, that you can grow as old as Methuselah, that you should forget about death, you see, that death is something that happens somewhere but shouldn't. You see, that it is a mistake, so to speak, to die. Despite, I think, this intrusion, there are two tasks which only the church in the future of this country can fulfill. And why people, obviously including the President of the United States, have felt that they have to establish a level beyond the political order and beyond the economic order. The problem of rabbi and minister, priest and cardinal, bishop and deacon today is to make clear that we can remain a unity, a country, the United States of America, even though the political slogans of democracy and the social slogans of capitalism may have to be dismissed, or changed, or transformed. A secular society which is nothing but held together by nothing but democracy must idolize democracy into something divine. And today democracy in this country is a pseudo-religion. That is, it substitutes for religion. The only thing by which America can be conjured today is democracy. Therefore, everybody trembles if everybody says a word against democracy, you see. But as you see in the papers, Mr. Nixon says a lot against democracy by becoming crown prince. That's monarchy. And in a good way, I mean, I'm all for it. But Mr. Nixon simply has to change the Constitution at this moment by an element which has absolutely nothing to do with democracy. We need somebody, you see, who is like a son or brother to the president. A prince, a crown prince, a prince of Wales, however you call it. An alter ego, you see, somebody you can lean on. You remember what I said about the friends of the president before, you remember? We had to talk about this social role in the leadership of the country. Now I warn you, you all in the next 20 years will be faced with tremendous changes because the balance between the Congress and the president and the judiciary is untenable once you have $40 billion in the annual budget to administer, you see. That gives the administration such an incredible power, you see, that in peace times, the president has as much power as he only has otherwise in wartime. You see, in wartime, you are satisfied that he can act as a commander-in-chief, you see, and do all of the other things. But if he has this spending power, you see, in his departments.
It is impossible by any other body, you see, to look into it. This is too complicated. It's a tremendous burden, you see, of government. That all over the world don't think that America is in any way isolated, but I think it is my duty to explain to you that whether we like it or not, that's not a question of wishful thinking or desire or faith or conservatism or loyalty, you see. It simply means that all secular forms of government are transformed. They have to be transformed. In which way I do not know, and I am at this moment absolutely ignorant of. I have no program in this matter, but as an historian, I can point out to you that this substitute during the 19th century of a common religion, democracy, you see, this using of a secular term for a religious is in a great danger to the future of this country. There are always three levels, you see, of behavior. The economy deals with things. The democracy deals with people, with men, with your brother. That religion deals with the direction, with the meaning, you see, in the name of which we condemn a murder. How do we know this? Isn't he a man, as we said? You have to, because you can't live in a society, you see, which does not recognize in the man murder, you see, an image of God. He cannot go and revenge, you see. Something has to be done when a man is murdered. Otherwise, you don't live in a community that can no longer say. And whoever persecutes a murderer is a governor. If in a democracy you have lynching in Mississippi, then it is quite indifferent, you see, what state or form of government in Mississippi prevails. Murder has to be finished. And if the democracy doesn't function, you have to find another form of government. It is ridiculous. Very simple. I always used to ask my students in Europe the question, just to tell you that this is nothing made up for the moment. To ask them, I was a professor of law for decades. When a murder happens in a desert, and some people gather and find out who the murder was intended, who is the governor? You see, there's no written law. Anybody who punishes murder in the desert establishes a government at that moment. They become the governors because they do what has to be done. Justice has to be done. He who does justice is the governor. Doesn't need election. And when I came to this country, I was great glee. I learned that Mr. Owen Whisker had written a whole book on this very same thieves of Virginia, in which this is explained. That those who execute justice are the government. And they did it in the name of God. Now, therefore, and when you religion is anything, you see, that is worth the sacrifice. I should put the word sacrifice in. You always worship where you are willing to give up your own will, your own intentions. Where there is sacrifice, there is religion. Because you say that a higher will must be done and not your own. Where your own will is be done, you are in politics. You fight as a minority against the majority. You want to win in the next election, you see. Your will is master, you see. And when it comes to economy, the climate, the soil, the materials dictate to you what to do, how to live. I mean, if you have no water in California and have just smog, you see what I need to do. What's the real estate lot here to do? So I think the real estate people, for their property, will do something against the smog finally. Because matter, you see, in economic sense is law, is imperative. You have to comply with what the soil and the climate and the fields and the gardens, you see, produce, otherwise we go to pieces. So there is, you like it or not, always are three levels, and the church is only the reminder of the existence of these three levels. The three is the whole function of the church or synagogue or the
Baha'is or the Christian Scientists or what have you, who have this aspiration of freeing you from this confusion, will all in some form or other tell you what is material, you see, what is human, and what is worth the sacrifice. People who love know this just automatically. Love is always worth the sacrifice, that's why we say God is love. But it is more inclusive. Love is not God, because there are other side aspects who also need a sacrifice. Your country is worth a sacrifice. The future of your children is worth a sacrifice. The law is worth a sacrifice when it is violated. So, sacrifice meets a religious level. People, I should say, mutuality, perhaps, or partnership meets the people and agreement, common life, and economy, the material world makes law. That's one thing. When people at this moment under the Russian onslaught crowded the churches, it was not only for an alibi to prove that they were no communists. People have, the intellectuals have sometimes hacked jokes about this fleeing into the churches as though it was just a question of anxiety, you see, to be recognized as good people. I don't think so. I think it was perfectly legitimate an attempt to spell out again the three divisions, the three levels of behavior on which all of us for the last 1900 years have to live and will have to live in the future. We must be completely indifferent to the needs of the economy. I mean, if they're small, you stay at home when you can. Or in our part of the country, it's ice. Only a fool goes out in Vermont when in winter time, you see, when the roads are icy, because as you know, you can't do anything. You are not master of captain of your soul in such a case. So you have to obey the material world to a certain extent. Or you can change it, perhaps. You can shoot a hole into the mountain. I always hope they open the jars there for us against the smog, you see. But they tell me it would work. Once you see this, you may have understood perhaps now a little better the whole disposition of my course here, where I'm trying to show you that on these three levels, the state of the United States, you see, has been moving. That in the 18th century, the incredible story has happened, which only has happened in the case of the Jews in Canaan before, that the church here was older than the state, that the political destinies of America were old in England, you see, the form of political life, but the religious life was free here, and the church was sovereign, while the colonies were not sovereign. Then comes the 19th century, where people transplay everything from their democratic experience in the churches into the democratic way of life of their secular government. And I think this, at this moment, if you want to rise again, you will have to balance the identification which you very simply accepted as your inheritance from 1800 and 1750. That the government of the United States, in all its various parts and aspects, counties and states and senate and so on, should emulate the sovereignty of the congregation in the church in the little town. That was the idea. We feel as unintimidated, feel as free, feel as secure in the large secular government, you see, under the open sky of the 48 states or now 50 states, and you feel well at home in the Little Red Schoolhouse and in the meeting house on the hills, where politics, where subordinate to the community in the church. So, the church at this moment is not yet able to do this. I think the flag of the United States is still flying above at this moment most of our churches. The churches have to prove that they are patriotic, for example,
And instead, that the government would have to prove that it allows the free growth of the churches. And I think, as I say, Mr. Eisenhower has a very deep feeling for this problem. And he expresses it in a very personal and simple way, but I think there's nothing superficial about this feeling of his that you cannot be president of the United States without pointing out to the distinct existence of these two levels, you see, of our life. More I will not say, because everybody will have to express it in a different form. Now the thing the churches, however, are at this moment doing, practically, is the so-called, as you know, ecumenic movement. The ecumenic movement is very much misunderstood, and I must sober you about it. There's nothing very enthusiastic about the so-called ecumenic movement of the churches. However, something tremendous, intellectually tremendous, for your thought, important thing, has happened or is happening at this moment. In the so-called World Council of Churches, which had its meeting, as you may have read, in this country, in Evanston, was it 3 years ago or 2 years? When was it? Does anybody remember the date? Evanston, Illinois, had the honor of being paying host to this great worldwide convention. In this ecumenic council of churches, all the churches are represented except the Roman Church and except the Missouri Synod. By and large, all the others are in it. That's not literally true, but out of 287, I mean, let's say 200 are there. Now, on what basis are these denominations there together? Are they perhaps together as a church? Not at all. It's a very secular congregation, aggregation, I should say. But something tremendous happened, something I would say very humble and very charitable. In their convention in Toronto, 4 years earlier, the members of the group passed the following resolution. The members of this Ecumenic Council of Churches have joined this council without thereby asserting that they consider any of the other churches as real churches. Can you see the problem? Here are the Baptists and here are the Episcopalians. Now Episcopalians, obviously, that the Baptists are non-conformists. They are a sect, they are not a church. And I come to this in a moment, how they argue this point. Why they say, by definition, the Baptists are not a church. They are a sect. The Quakers are not a church, certainly. They decline to be one. But they are indeed too many council, I think. The Englishmen certainly are a sect. The Mennonites are a sect. They are not a church. Yet they are indeed too many council. So the brotherhood of these people who represent these churches, who inside, speaking inside of themselves, call themselves church, you see, the humility or the brotherhood shows in that they are satisfied that the others are their brothers, regardless of the fact that they deny them this honorable title. So the tension, the incongruity, the discrepancy between what I think of myself and what you think of myself is victoriously born. No self-righteousness. They say, well, I hope, and my New Testament says, you see, I believe, have my memory. In the same sense, these churches say, I don't think, Mr. Neighbor, that you are representative of a church. But let's pack up, let's grow together, let's give time to this whole problem. Perhaps you come round to me, perhaps I come round to you. At this moment, I cannot give you the full title which you expect me to give you. You see, to be given. Now, I think that's the tremendous and the further sign of real mental intellectual humility. That Religion and faith have conquered theology, because theology, you see, defines what a church is, and therefore, by definition, the other group is not a church. But faith in the future compares, you see, to get together with our head of the absence, you see, of a definition. I think it's only the American influence that has brought this miracle. But in order to stay in real history, I have to tell you that it was a Dutchman, the Secretary General of this ecumenic organization, who has forced the denominational leaders to this concession. And it was a battle royal, and it was very difficult to achieve this. And therefore, I think the name of this man should be, you should have. I think I mentioned it before, but probably Richard van Boog. To sum this all up, the churches at this moment are in a movement, not as churches, but as a part of society. They are under social pressure, you see. It is not, these churches treat each other as social bodies of importance, as they wear gloves or parties, you see. And it is then, in this sense, not a movement led by theologians, you see. It is not a movement led by religious motives, but it is by social pressure. The reason, of course, is the growing disappointment of the laity with the squabbles of the theologians. And the theologians feel that they are no longer able to tell their Presbyterian members that they only are Presbyterian, and even the Roman Catholics have to cope with the fact that their Roman Catholic laymen have to live every day with non-Roman Catholic fellows and brothers. And therefore, it is the peoples in these churches who have, so to speak, limited the intellectual liberties of their leaders, you see, the intellectual pride of their leaders. The body down below has influenced the heads of these movements, and these people felt that they have gone too far in their divisions, and that they have first to assert now that there is some common bond, although they cannot spell it out what it is. A very mysterious situation, which bears out my contention that nobody can understand the movements which are on foot at this moment if he doesn't know to distinguish between church, state, and society. The ecumenic movement of the churches captures them as containers of unformed but hoping and faithful masses. And the society forces the ecumenic movement on the individual church. Because it makes the church tolerant for the first time, that it will treat as an equal an other group that in its heart of hearts with what church says heaven, second, not a church. Now may I give it identity after having shown you that we really are at this moment outgrowing the division of 287 denominations. It just happened in these last 20 years as a result of the two world wars, of course. And as a, that they are
was too eloquent now. The spirit has left me. Just give me a moment. Find my way again.
The ecumenic movement as a social movement just goes to show why we are very soon going to turn to the social movement of the last 150 years, because even the churches today are not faced so much by political problems of the governments inside of which they live, but with the pressures of inarticulate masses whom they fear to lose if they do not make concessions against their theories, against their theology, against their philosophy.
This was not what I...
Yeah, I wanted to define now a little better the sect.
A sect is that group, a church, as I said, it's quite au grand, which doesn't feel responsible for the whole tradition from Christ to today. They fear the Mormons are a sect because they say everything between the Apostle Paul and Joseph Smith was wrong. And we have an immediate new revelation and we can forget about the 1800 years. Stand for didn't do anything in the 1800 years, left us alone, abandoned us. The situation, you see, God created heaven and earth and he creates men. And then he sends his revelation, his savior, as the Mormons say. And after Christ has died, a vacuum, you see, of 1400 years, and then we begin all over again. Any church has to render accounts for its own place within the history of the human race. As I said, told you, the motto of my book, The Christian Future, is a quotation from an old father of the church of the year 1200, or 1100 as a matter of fact, Hugo of St. Victor, that's long ago, and I was a Roman Catholic, and I'm not a Roman Catholic, in which he simply says the church, of course, has existed from the days of Adam and Eve, and must last to the last church. And that has been the tradition, of course, of the read the Bible, where you can read that Enoch and all the three Jewish elders, you see, were of course sanctified and lived in the Church of God just as much long before Noah and long before Abraham, you see. That is very strangely today completely overlaid by, I think it comes from the rather childish interest the last 150 years they have given to the attempt of writing the life of Jesus. And they have concentrated on this moment in time and have never expressed the fact that through all time people have lived trying to do the will of God. And certainly the hero of all these treatises on the life of Jesus was quite sure of that. He never doubted this for a moment, that all men since the beginning of time have tried to serve their maker. So the very strange thing is that a sect can always be distinguished from a church when it says, I don't care how the people in 1100 were able to live or how, I begin from scratch. A sect begins from scratch in some way. It stresses one point. If you can say, if you want to lean over backward so to speak, equilibrate church and sect, the sect is only concerned with the question, how does who the living attain the good life? And the church is primarily concerned with the fact, how have at all times the souls, you see, been saved? The church is stressing, or that aspect which we call church in any generation would say, how has it always been possible to live the good life? Then, of course, the living generation will probably do well to inherit something of this form. And the sect says, I don't care, the Mormons say, I don't care what happened to all these Britishers in the past 1500 years. We, the Mormons, only care for the Latter-day Saints, you see. And the former-day Saints are not our concern. That's the sect. And I think this definition is a definition which is valid, because anything that concerns church, if you would like to help yourself in clearing up your confusion about society, state, and church, anything that deals with the church must be expressed in terms of time and not in terms of space. That your forefathers, you see, left Egypt under Moses, and that Noah made a covenant, you see, the rainbow, that expressed is still, as you know, on our dollar notes, you see, where the rainbow is still a symbol. That is, the identity through time is the problem of the church. The very little change that the one generation there undergo. And therefore, yeah? Oh, hell, I just said time, is it? So, I'm always to the point with you. Thank you.